secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard. This is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Tonight, from Midnight Theater, it's a special Halloween edition of Craft, featuring a dramatization of the short story Heaven Sent by Ohioan John Kachuba, presented by students from the Columbus City Schools Black Box Theater. Turn off the lights, settle in, and prepare to experience Craft with the story Heaven Sent.
Behind the wheel of the heaven-sent van idling at a stoplight, Rick saw a skinny boy crossing the street, a red backpack slung over one shoulder, and instantly he saw his kid brother Danny, his colorful X-Men backpack shining in the sun as he waited for the school bus. Then he imagined Danny on that last day, weighted down beneath his heavy field gear in the cruel sun somewhere south of Fallujah, the grenade cradled in his hands, and Danny lifting up his hands as if he were taking communion. Rick's hands trembled as they gripped the wheel. He needed a drink, but there was no time for that now. He tried to shake his mind clear of thoughts of his little brother, but they flitted through his brain like ghosts and would not leave him alone. There had been a closed casket service at the non-sectarian Willow Grove Cemetery. A Catholic burial service denied Danny the suicide. Father Schmidt was an old-time Catholic priest, the kind who thought he could walk on water and had no problem refusing to perform a Catholic burial, despite the church's more modern and conciliatory attitude towards suicides.
Screw him anyway,
Rick thought. It had been as hot that day as it was now. He remembered the Marine Honor Guard sweating in their dress blues, the black hearse and limousine gleaming in the sun like giant beetles. He was vaguely aware of a dove cooing from a tree, her cry intermingling with the mournful bugle tones of taps, the scent of freshly cut grass hung in the still air. The folding metal chair upon which he sat seemed to radiate heat, even though he and the other mourners were shaded beneath a white canopy. Rick was Danny's only sibling, and their parents were both deceased. Thankfully, Rick thought, knowing what her baby boy's death would have done to their mother. He already knew what it would do to him. He needed a drink. The crisply folded American flag handed to him by a Marine, the same flag that had draped Danny's coffin, felt warm in his hands, almost as if it were alive. He could not look up into the young Marine's eyes, afraid of what he might see there. The service came to an end, and the funeral director ushered the other mourners to their cars. Rick stood alone beside Danny's coffin. He tried to imagine his little brother in his mind, but whatever image he might have held was hidden behind a wall of grief.
Danny boy, what have you done? Where have you gone?
The light was green. The driver behind him leaned on his horn. Danny's ghost disappeared, but Rick knew he would be back. He drove slowly down the street, peering through the windshield, looking for 107 McKinley Place. Denise had said she would meet him there. Two blocks later, Rick turned right onto McKinley. A shady street line was small, a real estate agent would say, cozy, houses of 1920s vintage. Number 107 was a stucco and wood Tudor with a tall, narrow gable above the front door. The house was in good condition, looked almost new in fact, and the lawn was neatly clipped. A silver Lexus was parked in the driveway. A man and woman got out of the car as Rick pulled the van to the curb. He parked the van, grabbed a red plastic toolbox from the back, and walked up the drive. Rick was wearing the Heaven Sent Cleaners uniform, a dark blue jumpsuit with the company logo, a thin gold band encircling the words Heaven Sent embroidered over the left breast. He carried a clipboard in his free hand. Rick set the toolbox on the ground and introduced himself to the couple, Tony and Carmela Sorrentino.
I'm sorry for your loss.
It sounded mechanical. He had said it so many times before, but truly he was sorry for them. He knew what they felt.
Thank you,
Carmela said. She was tall and built like a linebacker, but her brown eyes were kind, her voice soft.
Your office said to give you the key.
Yes.
She dug it out of her purse, the size of a suitcase, and handed it to him. Rick noticed her red lacquer nails and Rolex watch.
How long will this take, Mr. Warren?
I'm not sure yet. I'll check the premises today and see what needs to be done. Then I'll bring a crew in. Usually we can take everything in a few days.
That would be fine.
Right,
Tony said.
We'd like to get this house listed as soon as possible.
He took a step forward as he said this, as if to assert his authority. He wanted to make it clear that despite the fact that he stood several inches shorter than his wife and many pounds lighter, he did, in fact, wear the pants in the family. Rick wasn't so sure. He noted the urgency in Tony's voice and knew his crew would have to get the job done on time. There had been too many screw-ups since Danny had died. Rick knew they were his own fault, but what could he do? His world had been blown apart with Danny's. Maybe there were no answers to be found in the bottom of a bottle, but all the questions simply floated away.
Poor Uncle Mario.
Carmela looked up at the gable rising over the front door.
This house was everything to him. He built it himself, you know.
Turning back to Rick, there were tears in her eyes.
Are you sure you want to sell it?
Sorry, as soon as he spoke the words. It was none of his business after all. His job was to clean the property, nothing more. The less he knew about the family's personal business, the better. That was a lesson he drilled into his crew. It was sometimes difficult to remain aloof to the emotions of family members, he knew that. But you simply could not perform a job like this if you let your emotions get the best of you.
Absolutely,
Tony said, talking around an unlit cigar.
We have no choice now that the old Uncle Mario has died in it. We could never live here. No one in the family could. We have to sell it. You can't live in a dead man's house.
Carmela didn't say anything, but she glanced uncertainly at Rick. He didn't think she was in the same hurry as her husband to sell.
What Tony means is that any of our family members would feel that it wouldn't be right to live in Uncle Mario's house. It meant everything to him, and we should respect that.
Bull! That's not what I meant at all. The place is cursed now. Jinxed!
Carmela rolled her eyes.
We've got to get rid of it.
Tony.
You know it's true, Carmela. You didn't waste any time selling Papa's house when he died, did you?
Rick didn't question the couple's superstition. After 12 years in the business, nothing surprised him. There were countless ways in which a person might handle the death of a loved one. Who was he to say that any one way was more valid than another? He couldn't find a way for himself. How could he find one for them? But he had work to do, and he wished that the couple would quit arguing so that he could get started. He stood there on the porch, sweating in his heaven-sent uniform, wishing he were somewhere else, anywhere else. Maybe Duffy's, where he could get a shot and a beer. That would be good. He looked up beneath the gable and saw a little spider dangling a few feet above Tony's head. Rick watched it climbing up and down its thread, then finally descending in a rush. Carmela saw the spider and swatted it away before it landed on her husband.
What?
Tony said, quick stepping away from her. Rick saw a glimmer of fear in the man's eyes and was certain who really wore the pants in the family.
Nothing. A spider. You're fine.
See, that's what I mean. Bad luck.
Carmela sighed and shifted her purse on her shoulder.
Is there anything else we need to do, Mr. Warren, before you get started?
Just sign these papers.
Rick handed the clipboard to Carmela. She flipped through the papers, signed her name where Rick indicated, then gave him back the clipboard.
Would you like to come inside with me?
He didn't think they would. No one ever did. But he thought he should ask anyway as a courtesy. Carmela shook her head. Tony said,
No.
All right, I'll call you when we've finished, Rick
said. He waited until the Lexus backed down the driveway and pulled out into the street before picking up the toolbox and stepping onto the front porch. He opened the box, removed a pair of rubber gloves and a face mask with respirator and put them on. Years ago, such precautions would have been unnecessary, but the threat of hepatitis and AIDS from contaminated blood necessitated the gloves. The respirator was for the smell. Rick removed a camera from the box and slid it into a pocket of his jumpsuit. He tucked the clipboard under his arm and fitted the key to the door. He pushed it open and stepped into a small foyer. It was hot and stuffy inside the house. The windows all closed, the air conditioning turned off. He walked into the parlor. The uncle had been a suicide as well. Rick had a copy of the police report on his clipboard and he looked up at the ceiling, at the hole there above the Barca lounger where the first bullet had lodged. The man's hand shook so much as he squeezed off the first round that, incredibly, he missed his head, sending the bullet into the plaster ceiling overhead. Cracks radiated out from the hole like spider legs. Somehow, after that failed attempt, the uncle steeled himself and pressed the barrel of the .38 against his chest. He didn't miss that time, but he didn't die right away. He managed to get up and stagger a few feet across the floor where he collapsed up before the fireplace, beneath the inscription on the mantle that read, Mine. Always mine.
How had he been able to do it?
Rick wondered. Why hadn't the reverberation of the pistol echoing through the little room, or the ringing in his ears, or the acrid smell of the powder burning his nostrils, or even the bits and pieces of plaster raining down upon his head, why hadn't any of that jolted him from his death wish? How was it that after that startling first miss, he was still able to collect himself and say, "Yes, I really did mean to die. Let's try it again, shall we?" And how is it that Danny, a good Catholic, could have stood there in the sun, the live grenade in his hands, as his fellow Marines dove for cover? Could he really have smiled as it was reported he did, before blowing himself to atoms? Rick shook his head and blinked back the tears. There were things that surpassed all understanding. In addition to the police report, Rick also had a heaven-sent cleaner's worksheet attached to the clipboard, which he now consulted. He took a pencil out of his pocket and drew the floor plan of the rooms on the form. He walked around the rooms, making notes as he went and taking pictures of the damage for any insurance claim the survivors might want to file. As he went through each room, he removed the personal photos hanging on the walls and stacked them neatly in a closet so that his crew wouldn't be reminded of the person who had left the grisly remains behind. He snapped a photo of the burgundy-colored Barca lounger. The fatal bullet had lodged in the man's chest, so there were no bullet holes in the chair. But there was a partially bloody handprint on one of the arms of the chair where the uncle had pushed himself up. Rick bent down to examine the chair and determined that it was covered in vinyl, a material that could easily be cleaned, depending on, of course, on whether or not the Sorrentinos even wanted to bother with it. Most of the time, the survivors threw out such damaged pieces. Rick noted on his forms the drops of blood. Protein was a term he instructed his technicians to use, that splattered the oak floor between the chair and brick hearth before the fireplace. A second handprint stained the brick. There was a large spot of blood, maybe 2 feet in diameter, on the floor in front of the hearth, where the man had collapsed and died. He squatted near the stain, studying it. 6 quarts of blood pumped through the human body, and Rick thought the man had left much of that blood on the floor. The thick stain was almost black, except near the center, where there was a small mass of reddish tissue that had oozed from the man's chest. Rick noticed that the floors were in need of resurfacing, which meant that the blood would have soaked deeply into the dry wood. He stood and scanned the room. Rick was accustomed to the incongruity of blood and bone, bits of flesh and tissue in a domestic setting such as this. Last week's newspaper turned to the sports page, a cheap reproduction of Da Vinci's Last Supper hanging on the wall, a dry palm frond stuck behind the frame, a pair of eyeglasses lying open on the table beside the chair. Rick knew that if he went into the kitchen, he would find family photos, kids mostly, held in place by little plastic fruit magnets on the refrigerator. A medicine organizer with various colored pills and capsules stored in plastic cubicles, each marked with a different day of the week. A favorite coffee mug, perhaps depicting a beach scene with blue sailboats on the horizon, resting on the counter by the sink. Rick thought that maybe even more than the gore of a messy or violent death, it was these little tokens of a life no longer lived that made it difficult for family members to come back to the house to do what must be done. Still, they could not be expected to enter a place that resembled an abattoir, and that's where Heaven Sent Cleaners came in. It was a profession that few people knew anything about, and even if they did, few would want the job. Yet, it was a valuable service that Heaven Sent provided. Rick knew that most people understood little bit about death. They didn't realize that death was messy. The bowels give way. The bladder lets go. There may be vomit. And in the case of a violent death, blood, body fluids and fecal matter, bone fragments and hair, tissue splattered everywhere.
Who would clean up such a mess?
The bereaved? Not likely.
It would be me.
As proud as he was of the work he did, reclaiming some dignity for the dead and helping the survivors work their way through grief, it was a job that wreaked havoc on his social life. Dating him was as bad as dating a mortician. He recalled a recent date with a woman named Helen that had not gone well.
"The bones are the last to go, of course,"
he had said, mistakenly thinking the process of putrefaction fascinated her. He twirled up a forkful of spaghetti. Helen paused, her fork arrested halfway between her plate and her trembling lips, and Rick knew that once again, he had gone too far, too fast. Yes, there it was, the color draining from her face as if she was about to toss what little she had eaten of her $18 veal marsala. Rick knew from experience that once this first date was over, he would never see her again. Over her dead body, she would say, and he almost laughed out loud at the thought. But there wasn't really anything to laugh about. Not when you're a 35-year-old bachelor with no prospects.
"Don't let it bother you,"
Danny had once said, in a rare role reversal between them. Danny giving advice to Rick.
"You're a great guy. Some woman will find that out. It will happen."
That was easy for Danny to say,
Rick thought. Danny with his string of girlfriends, and now his widow. His thoughts of Danny flowed into the gloom of the cloistered little house, weighing upon him. It seemed as though a dense and suffocating fog had suddenly filled the room. He couldn't stay in the house any longer. Later that night, as he lay on the couch in his apartment, watching the latest news from Baghdad on the television, Danny was with him once again. It had been one of those days, and Rick knew he had brought it on himself. In the year since Danny had died, Rick had tried to avoid the news as much as he could, but the televised sights and sounds provided some unexplainable psychic link to his little brother. Almost as though Rick could bring Danny back from the dead, suit him up in his dust-colored uniform again, and maybe this time, someone would rescue him from his demons before it was too late. Danny's demons came to life for Rick in the last letter his brother wrote to him. The letter arrived 2 weeks after Danny's death. Written in an unfamiliar scrawl, it was an emotional, barely coherent letter, in which Danny rambled on about a nighttime firefight in a small village, bulldozing a wall, finding the bodies of an old man and several children beneath the rubble in the morning. Such a tortured letter from Danny, who had coached basketball at St. Rita's school, who had wanted children of his own someday. How had things gone so horribly wrong? And now the church declared that he would spend eternity in hell as a suicide? Rick could not accept that. His brother was a good man, used unwittingly by bad men for bad purposes, yes, but a good man at heart. Rick could not believe that Danny's soul would be damned simply because he had, in one utterly desperate and faithless moment, sought his own justice. No merciful God would allow such a thing, would he? Rick was back at the house on McKinley Place early the next morning with the crew of four Tyvek-suited face-masked and glove technicians. He called Carmela Sorrentino from the house on his cell phone and asked her about the chair, being careful to tell her that the lounger was soiled rather than bloody. And did she want to keep it? As he expected, she answered in the negative. Rick had two technicians clean it anyway and load it into the van. It would later be donated to the local Goodwill store. The bloody rags used to clean it would be bagged and sent to a medical waste disposal center to be sterilized and then incinerated. The other two technicians were on hands and knees, working rags and cleaning solution over the bloodstains on the floor. Although naturally right-handed, they scrubbed the floor with their left hands, a company policy Rick had established to remind them all that there was nothing normal about finding a dead body in a home. Nothing normal in what they were doing, and they should never consider such death to be normal. The smaller stains, the trail of spots from the lounger to the hearth, came up easily. The handprint on the brick took a little more work, but it too was finally eradicated. It was the large blot before the hearth that caused them trouble. They worked on it for hours, but as hard as they scrubbed, they could not remove it entirely. It was no longer as vicious as before, and the dark color had faded a purplish gray, but it was still there. Rick was worried. This was an experienced crew. Maybe if they let the stain dry out thoroughly, they could attack it again the following day. Rick told the technicians to pack up. The next morning, Rick went to the house alone, thinking he could probably take care of the remaining stain himself. After the previous day's cleaning, there was little risk of being exposed to contaminated blood, But Rick donned his protective gear anyway.
Better safe,
he thought. Inside, he opened the curtains and let the sunlight flood into the little parlor. He knelt on the hardwood floor beside the stain. He ran a gloved hand over it, but felt nothing but wood. All traces of pathology, as he called the physical remains, removed. Using the strongest cleaner he had available, Rick carefully and diligently scrubbed the stain, working the cleaner into the wood inch by inch. It took him 3 hours to work over the entire stain, and when he was finished, it looked perhaps a shade lighter, perhaps not.
Damn!
Again, he let the solution dry overnight and returned the following day. Again, he was thwarted in his attempts to remove the stain. He had no choice but to call the Sorrentinos and tell them what was happening. In Rick's opinion, they would have to replace the floorboards before selling the house.
What are you talking?
Tony Sorrentino said over the phone.
That would cost us a bundle.
The insurance would probably cover it,
Rick offered, aware of the irritation in Tony's voice.
Yeah, maybe. I want to see it first, can I?
Sure. It's your house.
Later that day, Rick met the Sorrentinos at the house. He stood on the covered porch, sheltered from a heavy rain that had begun earlier that morning and showed no signs of stopping anytime soon. He watched Alexis pull into the driveway. Tony and Carmela made a dash for the porch, she holding her purse over her head. Although wearing his blue jumpsuit, Rick did not bother with any of the protective equipment as he unlocked the door, the threat of disease having long since been eliminated. Tony and Carmela entered timidly, their first visit to the dead man's house since he had shot himself.
Oh, Jesus,
Carmela said when she saw the stain. She covered her mouth with her hand and stared. Rick wondered if she was going to be sick.
Oh, Jesus is right,
Tony said, circling the stain, eyeing it as though looking for a way in.
You guys couldn't get this out?
We tried everything.
Jesus.
It's Uncle Mario.
Carmela had drawn closer to the mark on the floor, yet her voice sounded far away.
What?
He's still here. He's still in this house.
Come on, Carmela. What are you talking about? You're giving me the willies here.
Don't you see, Tony? It's a sign. Uncle Mario's spirit is still in this house.
Rick saw Tony's eyes dart quickly around the room, as if he was looking for the dead man.
We can't sell the house.
Tony stopped pacing.
Tell me you're joking.
He's not at peace, Tony, and until he is, we can't sell the house.
We can't just tear up the damned floorboards like Rick said, put down a new floor.
She shook her head.
That won't make a difference. His spirit will still be here.
Rick stood watching them, listening to their conversation. It was comical at first, but there was something in Carmela's stubborn insistence that her dead uncle was still among them in spirit that tugged at Rick. He was suddenly uneasy in the house, an emotion he had never felt before in all the many houses of death he had entered over the years. Despite the cold rain falling outside, he felt a trickle of sweat run down his back. An image of Danny in uniform flashed before his eyes, startling him. Tony was pleading with his wife, whining to her about repairing the floor and selling the house immediately, but she was having none of it.
This was a woman used to getting her own way.
And she did. She politely thanked Rick for the work Heaven Sent Cleaners had done and told them she would mail the check in the morning. To her husband's inquiries about what they would do with the house, she simply said she had an idea. Never in the 12 years since Rick had founded Heaven Sent Cleaners had he failed, as he did at 107 McKinley Place. It mystified him completely. Blood. That's all it was. Why couldn't he get it out? He was thinking this all the next day as he shuffled through reports and bills at the office, and he was still thinking about it when he stopped in at Fiona's cafe for dinner. On the way back to his apartment, he found himself driving down McKinley, as if the house itself had called him back for yet another try. Ridiculous, of course. He didn't even have the key anymore. Still, he slowed as he drew near the house. There was a car in the driveway, and it wasn't the Sorrentino's silver Lexus. He pulled over to the curb and looked toward the house. It was dark, but as Rick watched, a faint light seemed to wash up behind the parlor window. The light grew stronger until a distinct yellow gleam shone forth.
What the hell was that?
Had someone broken into the house? He got out of the van and quietly shut the door. Cautiously, he made his way up the steps to the porch. There was no sound coming from the house, but now he could clearly see the yellow light spilling from the window. From the porch, he could peer into the parlor window, the curtains still open just as they had been when he last visited the house. The yellow glow emanated from a spot before the hearth where a ring of candles surrounded the indelible stain. Rick saw a dark figure sitting on the floor, silhouetted by the candle's glow. The figure's back was turned to the window. The rest of the house remained in darkness.
This was no burglary.
But what the hell was going on? Almost without his volition, Rick stepped to the door and carefully tried the doorknob. The door slowly opened. He could feel his heart racing. He stepped inside, gently closing the door behind him. The figure across the room never moved. He crept closer.
Please be quiet.
Rick froze, startled by her voice. She hadn't turned to look at him. He slowly walked toward the figure until he was standing alongside her. In the candlelight, Rick saw that the woman was probably in her early 30s. She sat calmly, her legs folded beneath her. Her long black hair was fashioned into a braid that hung down her back. It lay like a glistening black snake against her white dress. Her eyes were closed.
Who are...
She opened her eyes. Rick noticed they were blue, and placed one finger across her lips for a moment.
Sit, please. I'm almost finished.
Rick lowered himself to the floor and sat beside her, watching. She had closed her eyes again, and he wondered how she could be so calm, so trusting in the presence of a stranger in a dark and empty house. The woman was silent and still. He studied her face, inscrutable as a mask. He noticed how the candlelight played upon her hoop earrings. After a few minutes, she slowly opened her eyes, as if only then coming fully awake. She turned to look at him.
My name is Gwen.
What are you doing here?
She got up, walked to the wall switch, and turned on the lights. Then she came back to the ring of candles, leaned over, and began blowing them out. A smoky scent wafted through the room. Rick watched in silence. He thought he should be angry with this strange woman, fooling around with what he considered was still his responsibility, the blood stain on the floor. But he found that he was not angry. He was, in fact, curious.
Carmela Sorrentino hired me. She wants this house cleansed.
That's already been done. By me.
No, not cleaned. Cleansed.
She collected the candles in a canvas tote bag Rick had not noticed before.
There's a difference. You remove the physical presence of the dead. I remove their spirits.
You're a witch.
Thinking that was not exactly the right word, but not knowing what else to call her.
No, not a witch. A psychic.
You see dead people?
Not in the Hollywood way that you're thinking about, but I can communicate with the spirits of the dead. Yes, I can help them move on to where they belong.
And Carmela hired you to help her dead uncle?
Gwen nodded. Rick stood there for a moment, thinking. He looked at her in the bright light. He could see that she was pretty in an ethereal sort of way. She was thin and delicate looking, her face pale. But looking into her blue eyes, Rick could see she reflected there an inner strength that momentarily flustered him.
So how's it going?
I certainly feel the presence of Carmela's uncle in the house. But I sense something else as well. I don't know what it is yet. In any case, I'm finished here for tonight. I'm tired.
Gwen picked up her tote bag and started for the door. Rick followed.
Tonight? Do you mean you're coming back again?
She opened the door and stepped out onto the porch.
Tomorrow night.
Rick closed the door behind them and walked down the steps with her.
Listen, Gwen, would it be all right if I joined you tomorrow?
Why?
He really didn't know. Was it merely professional interests in an unorthodox stain removal method? Something else?
Just curious, I guess. Is it all right?
I suppose so. I'll be here by 8.
They were standing by her car.
Thanks, by the way.
He said, extending a hand.
My name is Rick Warren.
She shook hands with him.
I know.
That's right. You're psychic.
No, Carmela told me.
Rick was at the house the next night before Gwen. He waited in the van until her car turned into the driveway, then got out and walked with her to the house. Inside, Gwen again placed the candles in a ring around the bloodstain and lit them. Rick turned off the lights and sat on the floor beside her.
What now?
We wait in silence.
They sat for a long time, Rick shifting his weight every now and then on the uncomfortable hardwood floor. He looked at Gwen, who, as she had done the night before, sat serenely, her eyes closed. Rick watched the candles flickering in the darkness, watched their shadows dancing, and felt as though they were drawing him in, as though he were shrinking down into the glowing circle of light. He thought dimly of time passing, but didn't know how long he had been sitting there, or even a very odd sensation whether he was actually there or not. He felt disconnected, adrift, and he thought of Danny, also adrift, wandering, and the hot tears were in his eyes, and then he saw one of the candles move. He was certain of it.
They're here.
Rick felt the air suddenly grow cold. A shiver ran down his spine. His eyes were open, but there was nothing to see other than the candles and Gwen. Her eyes were now opened also, and she seemed alert, listening, her head cocked slightly to one side.
Who is it?
Mario. He's confused.
Rick was aware of a strange feeling in the house, a thickening of the air, if that were possible, and a light, tingling sensation, like a buildup of static electricity. He felt the hairs on his arm rise up. He did his best to ignore these feelings and focused on Gwen. A faint smile crossed her lips, and she nodded her head as though agreeing with someone in a conversation. She raised her right hand from her lap and extended it, palm up, to the circle of candles. Rick watched her eyes track something unseen from the dark corner of the room to the halo of light.
Yes.
Then after a few moments, she said quietly to Rick,
Mario's gone. Now there's only the other.
The other?
He had no sooner spoken those words when his mind filled with images of Danny. They came in a swirl, a mental blizzard that threatened to overwhelm his senses. Danny on his bicycle. Danny in his baseball uniform. Danny trying to play Rick's guitar. Danny sitting on the porch swing with his first girlfriend, Rachel. Danny in his Marines dress blues. Danny in a dusty tent writing his letters home. Danny holding the grenade. Rick felt as though his heart would explode. He was no longer sitting up, but he was slumped over, his head nearly touching the floor, as Danny raced through every nerve, every bone, and every vessel within him. He was filled with Danny. He was Danny. He felt the pain of the last year, the paralyzing depression unwinding inside him, uncoiling and streaming through him like psychic surgery. Rick sobbed. He felt a hand touch his back, and he knew it was not Gwen. At once, a great calm descended upon him. The images of his little brother disappeared, and there was now only a light, like the candlelight, filling him. He slowly rose up and looked at Gwen. She smiled at him, and he noticed the tears in her eyes.
I don't have to worry about him anymore, do I?
No, he's at peace.
Rick sighed. Gwen reached over and took his hand.
And so are you.
That was the short story, Heaven Sent, by Ohio writer John Kachuba. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the performance as it was put on by the students of the Fort Hays Black Box Theater, led by Steve Black. My appreciation goes to them and to John Kachuba. Join me every Wednesday at 8 o'clock for Craft on WCBE, Central Ohio's NPR station. You can hear many of the past shows from Craft at www.craftheshow.com, or you can visit facebook.com/craftheshow. Let me just say, I hope that you've enjoyed your time here. Crawl under the covers and try not to think of the ghosts that might be haunting your house. The ghosts of the stories that you haven't written and sent to me. So, have a good night, happy Halloween, and remember, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. on Central Ohio's NPR station, listen to Craft. Have a good night. And as always, be creative.